This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the education channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Tom DeSena, from the Department of Communication, Journalism, and Public Relations at Oakland University. My guest today is Michael Gratz, the author with Ian Shapiro of The Wolf at the Door, The Menace of Economic Insecurity and How to Fight It. In The Wolf at the Door, Gratz and Shapiro argue that Americans care less about income inequality and more about their own insecurity. As voices on the right of the political spectrum call for further tax cuts and deregulation, and those on the left for broader redistributive policies, and both sides call for restricted trade to protect jobs, Wolf at the Door focuses on the concerns of ordinary Americans: secure employment, stable status, and safe communities. Gratz and Shapiro propose that these can be achieved not through protectionism or class warfare, but a return to the hard work of building coalitions around realistic goals and seeing those goals through the political process. The book makes substantial recommendations for increasing jobs, improving wages, protecting families suffering from unemployment, and providing better health care and child care, and they guide us through the strategies needed to enact change. My guest, Michael Gratz, is the Wilbur H. Friedman Professor of Tax Law and the Columbia Alumni Professor of Tax Law at Columbia University. He has served in the Department of the Treasury and is author, with Ian Shapiro, of Death by a Thousand Cuts, The Fight Over Taxing Inherited Wealth. Michael Gratz, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thank you, Tom.
So I want to start with a blurb from the back of my copy of your book from David Gergen. And it begins, "It is now beyond debate that rising inequality is not only leaving millions of Americans living on a sharp edge, but also is threatening our democracy. For activists and scholars alike who are struggling to create a more equitable society, this is an essential read." And so I don't know if you have a copy of your book in front of you, but on page 29, I think you offer what I think is one of the a really great synopsis of what you're describing. The first full paragraph, beginning with "But the fundamental problem." I was wondering if you could read that for us.
"The fundamental problem, arising from many causes, is the insecurity facing the hollowed out middle class and those living in or near poverty. It typically takes two working parents to provide an adequate family income, but single parent households abound, especially among women with less than a college education. Life expectancy for both men and women at the middle of the income distribution has dropped in recent years. There is an epidemic of drug abuse and even suicide among working class white men in America. In 2018, one-fourth of middle American adults said that they had skipped some kind of medical care because of its cost. Total household debt is now nearly $14 trillion. surpassing the previous peak in 2008, with most of the increase since then having gone to pay for cars and colleges. Defined benefit retirement pensions are a relic, leaving retirees vulnerable to the vicissitudes of business cycles and financial markets. Labor unions now represent just over 10% of workers, with the majority of those in the public sector. Rising costs have put adequate housing out of reach for millions of Americans. In 2017, a worker had to earn $17.14 an hour, nearly 2.5 times the federal minimum wage, to afford a one-bedroom rental home without spending more than 30% of his or her income. Middle-class fathers and mothers struggling to make a living now fear, with good reason, that their children will be worse off than they are.
So that's a lot. And your book offers a variety of different solutions to combat some of what you just read. In chapter 2, you suggest that there are 6 building blocks for constructing a distributive politics. Can I ask you to walk us through these 6 building blocks?
Sure, Tom. I should say at the outset that our book, as you know, is about both policy and politics. And in these building blocks, we are focused not on electoral politics, but on legislative politics, the politics that are necessary to get change in America. And the 6 building blocks that we describe are, first and most importantly, to think about coalitions. So the political science literature is filled with suggestions that people should think about the median voter and that the legislature will necessarily approve changes that are supported by the median voter. But there's an awful lot of evidence that middle and lower class Americans have very little sway in the political process. And therefore, we need to build coalitions that will be effective in getting the kinds of changes that we need to combat economic insecurity. A good example here that we use in our book is the Occupy movement. And you may remember that the slogan of the Occupy movement was, "We are the 99%. But the 99% is not an effective coalition. It's very hard to find anything that 99% of Americans would agree on. And in order to get business done in the legislatures of the country, federal legislature as well as state legislatures, you've got to have an effective coalition. Once you build a coalition, you have to keep it together. And here, the second building block is that you must have something beyond self-interest to keep the coalition together. If you just have self-interest in terms of dollars, somebody can always create a blocking coalition by promising people more money. What will keep a coalition together, and this is based in part on the work that Ian Shapiro and I did on the coalition that was successful in repealing the estate tax, is to have moral commitments, to have a moral argument for why the change that you're proposing is good and important. It's necessary to have those kinds of commitments in order to keep coalitions together and to block opposing coalitions. The third building block is to pursue proximate goals. We have been criticized, actually, from many on the left, that our goals are too incremental, not far-reaching enough. And here, I would cite for you Bob Greenstein, who was the head of the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities and one of the most effective advocates for low-income individuals in the last generation in America. And he says, that when you get the opportunity, you have to try and move two steps ahead. And when the pendulum swings back, you've got to be careful only to go a half a step backwards. And that's the way the U.S. political system has been designed, is so that incremental changes are usually the only ones that are possible, except in wartime or during the Great Depression. And then you have to entrench your proximate gains. That is to say, when you are successful in the legislative process, you have to make sure that you've created a mechanism that will allow it to be expanded for its full opportunity. And here there are two examples. One's the classic example of a successful entrenchment, which is Social Security. Franklin Roosevelt, for political reasons, mostly having to do with Southern Democrats, left most African Americans out of Social Security when it was originally enacted by excluding agricultural workers and domestic workers from its scope. But over time, it expanded, and the financing mechanisms of Social Security have made it impossible politically to undo, despite efforts over the years, including during the George W. Bush administration, to privatize Social Security. The fifth of our building blocks is resources. And you need resources to be successful in a legislature. Typically, this requires money. But if you don't have the money, it requires people who are willing to go and work and meet with legislators and put a lot of energy into their efforts. And then the final thing that we insist that you need is effective leadership. Somebody has to hold the coalition together, has to create the messaging, and has to really play a role in organizing and maintaining the effectiveness of a coalition once you've created it.
So it's interesting to me, so many of what you've just described, and I suspect, and again, you said you've been criticized on the left for the idea of pursuing proximate goals, but because so much of the rest of this is so much like a template for social movement politics.
Absolutely, absolutely. It is in fact, almost necessary to have a social movement. And it's difficult, as you know, both to create and sustain social movements.
Yeah, especially the sustaining part. The energy dissipates over time for all but a handful of issues. So let's then delve into some of your specific proposals for combating income insecurity. The book has a chapter dedicated to kind of the failure of leveling the playing field by using housing policy, but then goes on to identify a number of different things that we can do that, again, will sort of pursue these proximate goals. The first of these is to expand the earned income tax credit.
Exactly. So the earned income tax credit was a policy that was produced in the 1970s during the Ford administration with the support of the Democratic leader of the Senate Finance Committee, Russell Long. And at that time, it was a fairly trivial credit that allowed some people essentially to receive a income tax credit, and if they didn't have enough income tax liability, to receive a check that would offset some of their payroll taxes. But over time, with both Republican and Democratic leadership, the earned income tax credit has grown into one of the major supports for increasing wages of low and moderate income workers. It's paid directly to the worker and is not given to the firm for raising wages, which often doesn't actually happen. And it has been enormously successful, but it has major shortcomings that we argue could be fixed, and fixed with a bipartisan support. First and most importantly, the size of the credits, which are several thousand dollars now for families with children, single parents included with children, are trivial for single workers without children. And so the main expansion that we call for is to create a robust earned income tax credit for single workers without children. The provision is unnecessarily complex. It has led to great benefits in its complexity for income tax filing operations like TurboTax and H&R Block.
H&R Block, sure.
And it also has penalties on marriage that really have kept a lot of low-income workers with single parents, particularly from marrying, because you lose credits as your income goes up. And the credit phases out at too low a level and too steeply. That is, it could be a much more gentle phase out that would go up into the middle class. So it needs improvement, but it has been enormously effective over the years. And it seems to us to be a proximate goal in the way that universal basic income, which is one of its big competitors, is not. Getting a coalition to support a universal basic income is virtually impossible in the United States. As we point out in the book, the left wants to add a universal basic income on to Medicare and Social Security and the earned income tax credit and other advantages for low and moderate income people. And the right wants to use the supporters of the universal basic income on the right want to use it to replace all of the benefits that now go to low-income folks. And so getting an agreement on universal basic income seems to me to be really pie in the sky, even though it has garnered support from folks on both the left and the right.
Yeah, it's a little similar to the idea of a negative income tax.
Exactly. A universal basic income could be structured as a negative income tax, which, as you know, Milton Friedman proposed. And on the left, Martin Luther King, in his last book, supported a universal basic income. So it has supporters on both the left and the right, but those supports are conditional on either maintaining or eliminating the entire edifice of protections and social insurance that we now have in the United States. So I just think it's not likely to happen. Expanding the earned income tax credit will make work pay without the problems that this has,
sure,
that the universal basic income has.
And as you said, it's already entrenched. It's been effective, and so it's just a matter of expanding on that.
Exactly.
So, one of the most interesting chapters I thought had to do with moving from unemployment to reemployment. Can we talk a little bit about the trade adjustment assistance?
Sure. Trade adjustment assistance was enacted during the Kennedy administration as an effort to provide transition for workers who lost their jobs due to trade, due to increased trade. At that time, trade was increasing particularly with respect to imports from Japan and from Germany. The automobile imports were a major example, and they had disruptive effects on workers. And trade adjustment assistance was supposed to be designed to move those workers from unemployment to re-employment. But it never worked. It was underfunded. You couldn't prove that you lost your job because of international trade. The labor unions didn't support it until it was too late because they were opposed to free trade. And it has really never worked, although its basic structure, which is to provide benefits and training to people who are out of work, is really a fundamentally important idea. And we argue for something that we call universal adjustment assistance, which would provide education, training, transportation where necessary, support for moving if you need to move locations, and so forth for people who lose their jobs without regard to requiring any individual to prove that they lost their job because of global trade on the one hand or technological change on the other. And we think this is extremely important, along with revising the unemployment insurance system, which itself is an archaic artifact of the 1930s.
And also, as you point out, is widely different depending on the state that you live in. Here in Michigan, for instance, we've been going through just incredible problems with our unemployment system, kicking people out due to computer errors and then claiming that they were committing fraud. And, you know, a few states over, the benefits are very generous. It's kind of a nightmare for people who have to confront it.
Yeah. In the 1930s, Franklin Roosevelt was fearful, I think appropriately fearful, that the Supreme Court that was sitting then would strike down a national program of unemployment insurance, even though he was clear, Roosevelt himself was clear, that we needed a national program. But instead, what we got was a state-based program, which, as you describe, has real variations across the states, including many states that really don't cover very many unemployed workers. In Florida, the number was about 11%. Some states, wow, it's as low as 9%. And there are incentives for states, as you describe it, including Michigan, to provide inadequate benefits. And so even if you're covered, the benefits are not enough to protect you during a period of unemployment. And one thing that the COVID pandemic revealed is the inadequacy of unemployment insurance. And so Congress had to build a national unemployment insurance program during the pandemic because of the shortcomings of the existing program. But the problem, of course, is that those were temporary solutions rather than permanent solutions. And it's very difficult to get a permanent solution to the problems of unemployment and the challenges of re-employment because there is no coalition of people who think of themselves as the future unemployed. Nobody likes to think of themselves as somebody who's going to lose a job until it happens. And unlike, for example, retirees, where everyone hopes to be a retiree, and the American Association of Retired Persons has been enormously effective in state and federal legislatures, there is no American Association of the Future Unemployed, and there's not going to be. And so it took the pandemic, really, for Congress to understand the weaknesses in the existing system, but then After the emergency has seemingly passed, Congress has lost interest in this issue.
Although, is this a case where this is a kind of approximate gain? It seems to me that even though, as you said, Congress has sort of lost interest in the issue and in the emergency phase of the pandemic seems to have passed us by, there is a lot of movement going on in labor markets. I mean, the idea of the Great Resignation and a lot of shifting around. Is this a moment that could still be a place where we could pursue approximate goal, perhaps not around the idea of unemployment, but around the idea of mobility in the employment markets?
I think it is. As you know, the evidence now is that many workers, most workers, are going to have to change jobs as many as 12 to 15 times during a lifetime. When I think of my students at Columbia or undergraduates at many colleges around the country, a lot of those young people view that as an opportunity to go from one job to another. But when you think about middle-aged men or women who have only a high school degree and who've been working at a job for several years, becoming unemployed is devastating, not only to their financial life, but also psychologically and in the home. You see things like domestic abuse increasing and the like. So this is really a deep and important problem. And people have been reluctant to move to jobs in recent years in America. The old slogan, go west, young man, move to a job. It just seems not to be taking hold among a wide range of Americans. Now, the good news is that the pandemic has demonstrated that with the appropriate broadband and the like, you can do a lot of jobs from home that people thought you had to move to. So there are opportunities here. And I do think that, as you suggest, structuring this as a solution to job mobility and improving and upskilling workers' prospects for income does have a lot of moral force, and the prospect of generating the kind of coalition that just looking at unemployment insurance would not. This is why we think that the Universal Adjustment Assistance program that we've proposed is, in fact, an approximate goal and one that could be reached with the right leadership and resources behind it.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
So you mentioned broadband, and I think this points us to another proposal that you offer, having to do with infrastructure. And of course, infrastructure seems to be one of those, it's sort of like the weather. Everybody wants to talk about it, but nobody wants to do anything about it. You offer a number of proposals for, if I understand it correctly, public-private partnerships to help develop our crumbling infrastructure.
We do. It is worth saying that when the book was written, it was before the Biden administration took office, and Congress did pass an important infrastructure bill in the past year. And so there is now more money from the public sector to do some of the things that we argue for, including not only roads and bridges and trains and the like, but also broadband in rural areas and so forth. And we do offer a number of successful examples of public-private partnerships. the revision of, and it's a really quite terrific revision of LaGuardia Airport, which Joe Biden famously referred to one of the terminals there as something you would expect in a third world country. And it is now moved through a public-private partnership into a really first-rate terminal, is one example. The Denver light rail system, which surrounds Denver and also provides important light rail transportation from the Denver airport to downtown Denver, has led to the revitalization of that area of Denver. You do have to be careful with public-private partnerships. There are incentives for politicians to take existing infrastructure and shift it to the private sector. The most notorious example of this, I think, is private toll roads. But the worst example of it is the Chicago parking meter system, which was sold to a private partnership because the mayor of Chicago then didn't want to raise property taxes and wanted to get a big infusion of cash and sold it for a lump sum, and then gave the private parties the authority to raise the meter prices and create a whole series of disadvantages for the people of Chicago. So we want to be clear that we're not proposing selling existing infrastructure. We're proposing a very careful bidding and guarantees in the context of financing public-private partnerships. But it does create opportunities for making public dollars go much further than they might otherwise go.
So let's then, we'll talk a little bit about, and you kind of bring a lot of these together into one chapter, an expanded role for Medicare.
Yeah, so there's been a lot of talk about expanding Medicare. As you know, Bernie Sanders and some others in the Democratic Party.
Medicare for all.
Urged Medicare for all. It turns out that that's an extraordinarily costly expansion of Medicare, and the option that has taken hold among members of Congress who want to be more gradual about it has been to lower the eligibility age for Medicare from 65, which is where it now is, to 55 or so. This is also an expensive expansion, because as you age, your health expenditures go up as an aggregate matter. It doesn't happen to everybody, but it happens to most of us.
Right.
And so we actually urge expanding Medicare from the bottom up and essentially creating a public option voluntarily for people beginning in their 30s to enter into Medicare. They'll be much cheaper to cover. And Medicare has been actually quite effective, although this doesn't come through in the press, at keeping medical costs under control because of its pricing mechanisms. And so this would be a successful way of expanding health insurance coverage for those who are not covered and want coverage without breaking the bank continuing to use public insurance only for the most risky of people.
Although the public option was rejected pretty soundly, it was defeated fairly soundly when the Obamacare legislation went through, whatever that was.
Well, it was defeated.
Why now?
Sorry, go ahead.
Why now is a more appropriate moment for that idea?
Well, the public option was defeated as a part of Obamacare, which was an option that would have allowed you to elect into a public program similar to Medicare. It was largely defeated, actually, because of the fact that Obama needed every Democratic vote at that time in order to get Medicare. And at that moment, Joe Lieberman of Connecticut was playing the role that we now see Joe Manchin of West Virginia playing. And many of the large health insurers were located in Connecticut. And Lieberman basically said that you couldn't get his vote with a public option. And so Obama had to give up on it. He's now no longer in Congress. And I think people have come to understand that a public option would create the opportunity for cost savings, which was the big gap in what Obama was able to accomplish in his Obamacare efforts. They were successful, I think, in increasing coverage. And the Biden administration has been successful in its first year or two in keeping options open at lower costs for many people to join Obamacare. But virtually all of the cost savings mechanisms, including, importantly, the public option, were eliminated as Obamacare went through the Congress. So this is an option to expand Medicare. I think that there are alternative ways of accomplishing this to what we suggest, but it is, I think, an original idea that has a lot of promise.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, trying to get 30-year-olds into the pool is absolutely necessary to get them in and reduce the costs overall. So let's move on to you have two ideas, I think, revolving around education. The first is for a guaranteed early childhood education.
Exactly. I think that education is extremely important, and I'm happy to talk about public school education as well. We have really discovered that there is widespread support, both in the blue states and in the red states, for early childhood education. Washington, D.C., to take one example, has a very effective preschool program, a public preschool program for 3-year-old and 4-year-old children. Cities like New York and Boston have done so, at least for 4-year-olds. Interestingly enough, the most successful program in terms of quality, at least as measured by the independent education specialists who grade these things, has been in Alabama. And Alabama has had a successful program. Oklahoma, another red state, has had a successful program. And it seems that the evidence is now becoming quite strong that early education really does have a long-term impact on children's outcomes in the labor market over time. And it also is a way of providing, beginning at age 3 or 4, hopefully at age 3, effective child care, where the U.S. has really been very inadequate in its support for child care, even in the context of two-earner families, where we know both parents really need to work in order to make ends meet.
Yeah, I thought the story that you tell in this chapter about the World War II era program that provided early childhood education for young people I've been telling my students about it. It's just such a neat anecdote. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, during World War II, all the men, working age men, at least, or many of them in the United States, millions and millions of them were off fighting, and women had to enter the workforce in order to keep particularly manufacturing going in the United States. The image, the classic image, of course, is Rosie the Riveter, a portrait we've all seen, I'm sure. And the government provided very successfully widespread early education for children during World War II. After the end of the war, this disappeared. But it is worth noting, and we also talk about this in the book, that the Defense Department, which you know has similar issues for its for its members, does provide a very effective early education for the children of the military. And so there are examples of how this has worked in the United States, both contemporaneous examples in the states and through the federal government, both through defense and through the World War II example. So we're really quite optimistic about this. This is one of the more popular pieces of the Biden proposals that so far have been stuck in Congress, but there is widespread support for it among both educators and parents, which is a pretty good basis for forming an effective coalition.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, the reason the World War II program was so interesting is that, as you point out, the young people who went through it, they had better health outcomes throughout the rest of their lives, and as you said, better participation in the labor markets, which I think, I guess that's what we all want, isn't it?
Exactly.
So the same chapter does talk about trying to improve K-12 education. This is a harder one.
Yeah, I think it's very, very hard. You know, we spent a lot of time really trying to find what we regarded as a successful proposal for improving K-12 education. You know, when I grew up, public schools were the way up and out it was the way in which parents were convinced that their children would do better than they had. I have to say, I have a daughter who's committed to teaching underprivileged children, and she's now taught in New York, Boston, and is currently teaching a fourth grade class in Oakland. And I spent a lot of time with her trying to find out whether there were systemic changes that we thought were going to be successful. And finally, Ian and I, after a lot of work, decided that the way that public education is improving in the United States is really school by school or district by district. Occasionally you'll get a leader of a school district that will be transformative in improving the quality of the public schools. And as you know, the charter school movement in the United States has been quite successful in some contexts and less successful in others. And again, it depends on the leadership of the organization. And what I've learned from my daughter who's a teacher is it also depends enormously on the leadership of each school. And so we didn't have a solution to this. And here I do think that it's worth just mentioning labor unions, because we are very supportive of increasing the sway of private labor unions, which have essentially, if not disappeared, have withered in the United States now for over half a century. And that has been hugely important in the legislative process, because it gives businesses huge amounts of power and ordinary workers no ready organizational support for their needs and so forth. But again, public unions have been something of a mixed blessing in the United States. And as we've seen in recent months and years, the teachers' unions are sometimes very effective and a force for improvement, but sometimes are are not only not a source of improvement, but are really blocking changes that might be very successful in terms of improving the lives of their students. I will say that we did look closely at both George W. Bush's efforts to come up with a federal system of improving education, and then Barack Obama did the same. And it turned out that neither one of them was something that you could count as a success. And so we just couldn't find a model that we could embrace on K-12 education. So I think there is no silver bullet to that, but if someone can come up with it, we'd be delighted to see it.
So the book then goes on to describe how to pay for this. And if I understand you correctly, you are proposing a value-added tax in place of some of the calls to tax the wealthy. Am I getting that correct?
Well, they're not really in place of calls to tax the wealthy. We're quite supportive of taxing the wealthy. Some of the proposals have problems. So that we do talk, for example, about a wealth tax, and I think that any betting person, and there seem to be a lot of gamblers now in America, if my television
isn't that amazing. That's one of the most remarkable things. I've noticed the same thing. It baffles me.
Exactly. If you watch television at all, you're constantly being invited to gamble.
My goodness.
But as I tell my students, if I were a betting person, and I am, I would wager a lot that the current Supreme Court would strike down as unconstitutional a federal wealth tax. There's a lot of evidence of that in a recent opinion of the court. And therefore, I don't think you can tax wealth directly. The most important taxes on wealth in the United States at the federal level are the estate tax and the gift tax. And they have, since 2001, been greatly decreased, with the support, to our great surprise, of over 60% of the public when they're asked in polls whether they'd like to get rid of the estate tax. Now, some of this has to do with the way the questions are asked and sure. The framing of the estate tax as a tax on death rather than a tax on wealth and so forth. But we would support certainly closing many of the loopholes in the estate tax. There seemed to be a movement in Congress to do that earlier this year, but it dissipated. There was a provision in a House bill that would have closed a lot of obvious and important loopholes that just disappeared somehow. It was a Democratic bill, and so I assume it disappeared at the hand of some Democrats, but it's very hard to do politically. You know, we're for taxing hedge fund and private equity owners and managers at ordinary income rates rather than capital gain rates, the so-called carried interest loophole. I'm certainly for increasing taxes on dividends given the reduction in the corporate income tax and so forth. But I guess the main point is that the kinds of programs and policies that we need to protect the middle class and below are expensive, and it's very hard to finance those programs
right.
without some broad-based tax. And it's become clear that the Republicans, who are against any taxes and have been since the late 70s, have been very successful in creating anti-tax attitudes. I think that's a social movement that has been enormously successful to the detriment of the country. And the Democrats have essentially surrendered. Joe Biden, as you know, has promised that he would not tax anyone over with less than $400,000 of income. Mm-hmm. Barack Obama's number had been 250,000, but when he got into office, it went up to 400,000. So the Democrats only want to tax the rich, and the Republicans don't want to tax anybody. And as a result, we have the largest debt in the nation's history since the end of World War II. And at that time, 95% of the debt was owed to Americans, whereas now close to half the debt is owed to foreigners. And so every dollar of interest that we pay on the federal debt, 45 or 50 cents, goes out of the country.
United States.
And so I think that if you look around the world at those places that have successful protections for economic insecurity and job loss and economic disruptions, the one thing that you find is that they all have value-added taxes. 170 countries now have value-added taxes. The United States is the only developed country that does not have such a tax. And it's a national sales tax, essentially. And right. If you look at polling data and you look at state initiatives for infrastructure and the like, it turns out that sales taxes are much more readily approved by voters and less disliked by voters than the property tax or the income tax. So I think it's ultimately going to be an essential part of creating an appropriate safety net in America, but we're a long way from it. And as you know, it's not something that we recommended in the short term, even though we would have eliminated a lot of people from having to deal with the IRS and having to file income tax returns as part of the proposal that we talk about.
And wouldn't that be nice? So may I ask, what's next? What are you working on as a next project?
Well, good that you asked. So I'm actually in the process of writing a book. I've made a lot of progress on it, actually. A book that Princeton University Press is going to publish on the anti-tax movement in the United States, which begins with Proposition 13 in California, which was a limitation on property taxes, and then took hold in the federal level and the massive tax cuts of Ronald Reagan's administration. And I think has been a major force in the country. I actually describe it as the most underappreciated and underrecognized social movement of the last 50 years. And so so that's the book that I'm now working on, and I'm hoping to finish it in the next 6 or 8 months and get it to the press. I'm hoping that it comes out at a time when there is no pandemic, which is our book was published just as Omicron, I mean, it's not Omicron, but just as COVID started invading the country. And this necessarily meant that the kind of attention to economic insecurity was overwhelmed by the health insecurities that everyone in the country was facing as the book was published.
Well, I'm going to look forward to seeing that next book. That sounds really fascinating. Michael Gratz, thank you so much for your time today.
It's a great pleasure, Tom. I'm looking forward to talking about the next one with you.
Very good. Once again, my guest today has been Michael Gratz, the author with Ian Shapiro of The Wolf at the Door, The Menace of Economic Insecurity and How to Fight It from Harvard University Press. My name is Tom DeSena, and you are listening to the New Books Network.